Welcome to Truth Will Out Radio. Today's date is Friday the 11th of December 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming live at radioalbion.com, because normally we would have Dennis Wise with us, the producer of Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told, but unfortunately he is ill. I haven't heard from him this week. I just trust that he is still continuing to improve and still continuing to get his strength back. But we do have a special guest with us this week. Horace is returning to continue with our series on Kevin MacDonald's Culture of Critique trilogy. Horace, good day, sir. How are you doing?
Well, Sven, yeah, thanks for having me back. And I'm proud to stand in while Dennis is away. And as I said last week, I wish him well.
Yeah, I think we had a good discussion last week talking about the first book in Kevin MacDonald's trilogy. But just before we get into that, I just want to put an advert in here. I interviewed Dr. Thomas Dalton earlier this week, and it was going to be for a Truth Will Out Radio episode. But it was a written interview because he doesn't do audio and visual interviews, but it is just the sort of topics that we cover here that we talked about. We talked about the reason for his translation of Mein Kampf. We talked a little bit about how he got interested in historical revisionism, and it was on the Daily Nationalist earlier this week. So for any of the listeners out there that missed that, if you look on the radioalbion.com site and look up where it says Dr. Thomas Dalton, I think you'll probably find that an interesting interview. Sorry, Horace, I should have said that before I brought you in here. This is the problems with doing live shows, I guess.
No problem. I'm interested, just is that the version of Mein Kampf you'd recommend reading? Because I haven't read Mein Kampf yet.
Definitely. He says that the original version, it didn't have headings in it. It was a bad translation. A lot of it was just not really understandable. So what he's done, he's put the English side by side with the German so people can check it. And he's also added the headings. He's also added footnotes. And the people that I know that have read it have said it's absolutely superb. Really, really good version of Mein Kampf. Very well worth reading or well worth purchasing. So yeah, I would recommend that one if you have yet to read it.
Great. Yeah, well, I'll head for that one. Yeah.
Well, where we were talking last time, when we were talking last week, just before we finished, it was a shame we did have to finish, because we just got onto a really interesting subject that you brought up, which is our altruism as a people. And I was really, really worried that you might say, oh, it's something we need to get rid of because it's caused us so many problems. And of course, you didn't say that. And I should have known better that you wouldn't say that. But our altruism is a really positive thing. The problem is not that we have altruism. It's not that we have charity and mercy and that we look after people. That's a really wonderful trait of white people. The problem is it's misused against us, and we are encouraged to extend our altruism to all these other races. They have their own charitable people, and it's up to them to be charitable to them. If we extend all our charity towards them, what about our own people? Once all our own people are looked after, then we can extend our charity to them. Once we don't have our own homeless people on the streets for a start, then we can start looking out for these other peoples. I know there is an excuse. Well, we went over to their countries and we interfered. Fair enough, we did interfere, so there is a moral imperative to do something to help them, but that should be done in their own countries, not over here in our country. The idea that we've got some duty to allow them in and look after them as if they are our own family is it's a false idea, and it's used to harm us, and it's used to benefit them. And again, as we were talking last week, it's all about competition. It's all about competition for resources. And these other groups, these other races, they understand that, and they work for the betterment of their group. And our problem, our main problem, seems to be that we don't work for the betterment of our group anymore. We've forgotten that we're in a competition, and we work to help these other groups out. And there is one particular group that does promote these ideas. And again, we are in a competition. There's nothing wrong with them doing that. The problem is that we don't identify it. And identifying it is what Professor Kevin McDonald does in his books. And in this second book, Separation and Its Discontents, he mainly concentrates on anti-Semitism, which is a way to deflect criticism of this group when they are advocating for these ideas, which are of benefit to them, but they're not of benefit to us. So when we say, point out that there is rather a large number of Jews involved in advocating for immigration and multiculturalism, which is a valid concern, they will accuse you of anti-Semitism for saying that, which will shut down the criticism. And at the same time, it will also cause other Jews to feel as if they're being persecuted, and it will heighten their sense of ethnocentrism. So it will give us guilt, it will silence us, and at the same time, it will cause Jews to feel as if they are an outer group and they're being persecuted by the Gentiles, and they need to identify with the Jews more because otherwise they'll be pogromed. They need to support the advocates for Jewry that they are. So that seems to me to be the main reason for this charge of anti-Semitism. Do you want any comments on that, on the introduction, what we talked about last week, or about separation and its contents, Horace?
I mean, I think it's absolutely crucial thing to focus on. It's no wonder that, you know, someone as intelligent and what's the word, perceptive as Kevin McDonald, you know, wrote a whole book about it. And it's such a superb book as well. I think it's just as good as or even better than Cultural Critique. The question of anti-Semitism, I mean, it's such an important thing to understand. Obviously, I mean, I think we spoke last week, you know, examining the word itself and what is meant by it. But yeah, I mean, what you just said about sort of the causes of it and the part it plays in, sort of, I don't know, I guess solidifying the Jews as a collective and sort of, I don't know, binding them together against the outsiders as they see it. I think that's really interesting, excuse me. Yeah, I mean, it obviously serves a function, doesn't it? And one of the bits that really interests me most, I'm not sure how much McDonald addresses it in this book, actually, but I'm sure I've heard him speak about it. It might be in various places, but is that it serves from what I would, I guess you could awkwardly call the upper Jews or the more powerful Jews or the more ethnocentric Jews as well. It serves, as I think you alluded to a minute ago, to they use it somewhat as a stick against other Jews, sort of more peripheral to the community or to the tribe, you know, worldwide, to make them fear any further assimilation. So I've got a Jewish friend who is becoming sort of increasingly concerned about anti-Semitism, and no wonder, because there's always various Jewish organizations inciting that fear among other Jews. That's one of the purposes that you know, their focus on anti-Semitism serves. And what it's doing is making this friend of mine feel more and more unsafe in this society, in which there is, as far as I can tell, there's no objective evidence whatsoever that Jews are in increasing danger. So it serves to sort of draw them back inwards, instead of assimilating, which is definitely something McDonald's spoken about. And I think that's a very important part of the picture.
Well, assimilation is the big fear, isn't it? Because if they become assimilated into the nation which they are guests in, then they cease to be separate to that nation. They become a part of it. They cease to be Jews. So it's an existential threat, assimilation is. This is why diversity can never work, because it you don't end up with diversity, you end up with destroying all the diversity. If the Jews were to assimilate, there would be no more Jews left. So it functions to prevent them from doing that. And that's the main reason, I think, for all these polls that they do. So that they can then say, look, it's rising. There's this terrible threat that we're facing. You have to associate with us, and you have to keep separate from the Gentiles. And on the other hand, they can also then say to the Gentiles, look, there's this big threat that we're facing. We need to have harsher laws. We need to have harsher punishments. And it needs to be just the slightest criticism of Jews needs to be stopped, because otherwise it can lead to the gas chambers. And that's the logic that's put across. And it, of course, it prevents there being any discussion about the things that we see in society if we also happen to see that Jews are involved in it. And that they do benefit from a lot of these things. And they also benefit from us not being able to talk about it. And that seems, I mean, this is what Kevin MacDonald says about separation and its discontents. He says, while a people that shall dwell alone focused on developing a theory of Judaism within an evolutionary framework, the present volume focuses on the phenomenon of anti-Semitism. The basic thesis of this book can be summarized by the proposition that Judaism must be conceptualized as a group strategy characterized by cultural and genetic segregation from Gentile societies, combined with resource competition and conflicts of interest with segments of Gentile societies. This cultural and genetic separatism, combined with resource competition and other conflicts of interest, tend to result in division and hatred within the society. So what he is saying there is that there is this resource competition and genuine conflicts of interest, which causes Gentiles to criticize or try to get band together to resist and to fight against this resource competition. And there is genuine conflicts of interest which cause that. But the Jewish argument is that it's pathological. It's just something that rises. It's a virus. It's a virus that is within the Gentiles, and it just suddenly manifests itself. And for unknown reasons, the Gentiles just rise up and they set fire to the moneylender's house, or they get rid of all the ledgers, the money lending ledgers. And according to them, it's just a totally irrational thing that Gentiles have. And they probably genuinely do see it as completely irrational, because they can't imagine what it's like to be us, and we can't really imagine what it's like to be them. So to them, it's pathological. But to Kevin MacDonald, looking at this, and he documents this, and he suggests that it's due to these conflicts of interest and the resource competition, which to me just seems common sense. We have limited resources, and there are going to be conflicts of interest when you are competing with another group over these limited resources. And this anti-Semitism device, charges or accusations of anti-Semitism, it prevents one group from identifying that the other group are doing it. So it gives them a leg up, really, doesn't it? Don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, just speaking from a Gentile point of view, perhaps a bit peculiar to call myself a Gentile, but not being Jewish, obviously looking at the Jewish question. I mean, it's a lot of the combination of things, like basically accusing us of anti-Semitism whilst causing us to be what they call anti-Semitic. That is infuriating and hypocritical, I would say, but it also seems unfair. Because, I mean, we think in those terms. I'm not sure to what extent Jews, I mean, presumably some Jews do, but we're speaking about this, what MacDonald calls a group evolutionary strategy, and that's the terms that he's speaking in all through this whole series. As a group strategy, it strikes me as like terribly unfair alongside everything else, and also, obviously very, very destructive. Arguing with this same Jewish friend that I mentioned, they've sort of shown some curiosity about how I've arrived at the position I have, and they've only got a partial view of it. But for me, I tried to explain, and there's no one, you really can't put it in one sentence. You have to range across not only a huge range of individuals and groups in this time, but also across time. And across places. Like, I mean, all this happens within a very important historical context from which it can't be separated. And I think nobody would agree with that more strongly than Jews, like the history of their own tribe. Maybe the part of that history is mythological, but, like understanding their own past, or at least having some narrative of their own past, is like intensely important to Jews, right? And so, like, confronting the Jewish question basically entails doing the same, like taking this several millennia long view of how things are. And what I was going to say about my Jewish friend is that I tried to explain to them that the thing that enrages me most is the muzzling, the attempts at muzzling and hate speech laws and lawfare and vilification as well, and defamation. I mean, you mentioned about the so-called virus of anti-Semitism. That is defamatory of our people, against our people, you know, by the people who say that. And that's, you know, why on earth should we accept that? I mean, well, the practical reason why we accept it is because we allow ourselves to be ruled by people who go along with it. And that's the key problem. We need to recognize ourselves as, you know, in the same way, you know, without wholly becoming Jewish, because we're not, we need to adopt some of their strategies to counter their, you know, what I would say is their aggression against us. And we need to recognize ourselves as a group and act as such. And that basically, I would say, means removing our whole ruling class and ensuring that traitors like them can never come to power again. Even then, I mean, you know, this has happened again and again and again in European history. So it's not even like you can solve it in one country. You need some kind of permanent and quite radical transformation, and it needs to. I don't know. I mean, I'm thinking of what you said at the start, but I've forgotten what. Yeah, I can't remember how I was going to finish that sentence, but yeah, I mean, we have to. We have to change radically without, I would say, losing those things that I think are good about us, like the altruism, as you said at the start of the podcast.
Well, that's the thing. That's the important thing. It's us that have to change. We have to start identifying as a group, because we are a group. We're an extended family. What you were pointing out there about how it seems unfair that we're silenced from talking about these things while at the same time we see these things going on. Well, of course, that seems unfair if you're looking at humanity as a whole. But if you're looking at things from a group viewpoint, it's not unfair to the Jews, is it? It works very well for them. It works great for them. It's not unfair to the Jews. They're just competing. The fault is with us, isn't it?
Yeah, and that, you know, it's a very interesting question of whether they're, well, both MacDonald and also Andrew Joyce has picked up this idea as well of deception and self-deception by Jews. As in, you know, part of their overall strategy is to lie to us and to themselves. Well, that really intrigues me. I think that's definitely true, very important thing. But it intrigues me, like, how much, I mean, can a person wholly deceive themselves? I mean, this is a big philosophical question. I don't expect an answer unless you've got one. But, you know, it's can you actually entirely hide from yourself the contradictions, or as it seems to me, of what you're doing? In my mind, whenever I've tried to sustain a lie, it causes me pain of some kind. And I don't mean that as a way of praising myself and saying how, you know, innocent I am at my core. What I mean is it takes a certain maintenance to continue a lie over time and, you know, among a lot of different people. And it has all sorts of, you know, to tell other lies to make things consistent with it. Like that, I did that as a child and maybe as a teenager, and I just eventually found it exhausting. So, you know, this idea that people can, you know, like transgenerationally lie and keep lying, including lying to themselves, that to me, I struggle to accept that. But, you know, MacDonald's not necessarily saying that it is wholly authentic in their minds when they do that. I'm not sure. Sorry about the noise here. I live on a busy road. Sorry. But yeah. Sorry, I'm not sure if I addressed what you were saying.
Well, I think we can't. We don't know what it's like to be a Jew. We know that we couldn't hold these contradictions, and we couldn't do what we would consider to be lying to ourselves. But we can't. We're not Jews. And I mean, you could bring up that instance of that. There's one particular famous Jew who says, "Well, it was real in my mind." And he was caught out lying, flat out lying about what happened in the Holocaust. And he just said, well, it was real in my mind. And that was it. That was his reasoning. And he moved on to the next subject. So, you know, we have an example there that they can do that. It doesn't affect them in the way that it affects us. That's the way I understand it anyway.
Or maybe it is causing them pain, but they feel like that's just worthwhile or necessary, you know? Maybe it's that. Because one other thing that he raises either in this book or in Cultural Critique is the like Jews have, like, I think biologically it's proven that they have a far higher propensity to neuroses. And maybe having had that trait for some centuries or millennia, they've adapted in ways that they can sustain that over, you know, years and years or decades maybe. But also, like, I think, like, just valuing honesty and fidelity in their own right, that does seem to me mostly a European thing. Not that nobody else around the world values those things, but it seems like in like deeply embedded in European culture, would you say?
Yeah, and possibly not deeply embedded in Jewish culture. I mean, do they raise up people for being the most honest or the most the highest fidelity? They raise up people that have made the most money, that are the most successful business-like, and they are very good at business. You look at the top 100 businessmen, and you'll find that there are a lot of Jews there. But I guess if you look at people who have been incredibly charitable through history and set up proper, genuine philanthropic types, like some of the ones that we find in the British Empire, like General Gordon. You don't find types like that amongst the Jews. They raise up people that do very well in business. And whether somebody does well in business or not is not dependent on whether they're honest. So it may not be something they raise up. Let me just point out something else as well. I mean, there is this difference that we raise up the warrior class and they raise up the class with the higher IQs, as we discussed last week. So we already know that there is... they praise different things to us and they selectively breed for different things to us as well. That's why we end up with a warrior class and stronger types that could fight in battle. And they ended up raising up a class that were very good at studying the Talmud and business and ledgers and money lending and things. So we do know there are these differences between us. And to me, it doesn't seem as if they particularly raise up honesty. One of, that they have the Kol Nidre prayer, where they take a vow that all their vows for the next year don't actually have to keep to them. And that's one of the vows that they take. So that says to me that honesty is not particularly revered in their society, and that would be as a natural outgrowth of just them being a different type of people to us.
And also just a quick thing about what you said about philanthropy as well. I mean, there is plenty of philanthropy within Jewish communities, right? I mean, it's like far more extensive, you know, Jews providing for the Jewish community, that is there. So, you know, but they have charity, but it's utterly interwoven with ethnocentrism. But what you said about honesty as well, we do obviously produce people. For some reason, Jeffrey Archer comes to mind, like people who just will lie to everyone they know persistently over years and build, like, you know, whole social positions on lying and stuff. But we refer to those people as sociopaths or psychopaths, right? Whereas if we were to be consistent, we might have to apply that to maybe, you know, a majority of Jews. I don't know, maybe that's going too far, but a majority of Jews, perhaps. But,
Well, you also mentioned fidelity there, and Jews are very well known for pretty much starting up the pornography industry, which is the opposite of fidelity.
Yeah, I meant fidelity in the sense of, if, say, someone tells you a story, how accurately you relay that story to the next person. I mean, you know, like, as in, like, recording technology, fidelity, that kind of thing. But also, yeah, to do with, like, sexual or familial propriety, I suppose. One other thing just about honesty and truth and how much it's valued as well. I think I probably mentioned him last week, but Gilad Atzmon, who is of Jewish ancestry himself, who I've done several conversations with, such an interesting guy. He he's really philosophical and I would say really honest in the way he tries to assess things. He's someone who's genuinely committed to philosophy, you know, for its own sake, not for the sake of, serving some social or ethnic purpose. And he's someone who actually rejects racial thinking. So he differs from us in that way. But he writes about, and he's not the only person, I don't know if he's the first person, but I've seen Melanie Phillips have a different take on this same thing. And she's Jewish, obviously. But it's the idea of Jerusalem and Athens, like as in two sort of spiritual poles, with Jerusalem representing obedience by and large, like embodied by the Ten Commandments and things like that. Whereas Athens is embodied by, say, Socrates, Aristotle, you know, philosophy, curiosity, more or less for its own sake. I mean, not entirely, but, you know, like that we take a particular, you know, Athenian types take a particular joy in discovering things, and they don't necessarily know where they're going with it. I think that's, I mean, I don't know how literally to take that, but I think that sort of dichotomy does map onto a lot of things. And well, Gilad himself, despite being of Jewish background, I think he clearly prefers the Athenian way. And I think it's quite a good analogy for the differences between the two races, I guess, if you call Jews a race, but the two groups anyway, Europeans and Jews, and maybe Europeans and others, I'm not sure.
Well, we were just using Jews and Gentiles earlier, using their terminology, just for ease of using it. There are obviously drawbacks to using those names, those words.
Yeah, I mean, I see that everywhere. People sort of like kind of mocking, like sort of pugnaciously referring to themselves as goys, and the common use of the word shekels, like among the dissident right, to mean any money. I find that a really curious thing. I don't do that. And you know, that's like quite, like you see that quite a lot of people, you want to send me some shekels, they mean a donation, right? It's like as if to say, I mean, I don't like it because I think it implies that receiving money is immoral, or, you know, I think that seems to be the insinuation. And I think, no, like, you know, it's okay to make money. It's between you and the person sending it, really. I mean, it's up to them. But I think that's an interesting thing as well. It sort of relates to what you just said.
Well, we also have the word kosher, don't we, that is used a lot, just particularly in Britain, the word kosher to use something that to refer to something that's genuine, not to refer to something that has been prayed over by a rabbi or slaughtered in the correct fashion, but just something that's genuine. You know, it just becomes part of our language, doesn't it? Well, getting back to Kevin MacDonald here, he says, no personal or ethnic attacks are intended here, but the charge that this is an anti-Semitic book is to be expected and is completely in keeping with the thesis of this essay. Because also part of his ideas here is that any criticism that there actually is of their group evolutionary strategy will be instantly dismissed as anti-Semitism. No matter if it's correct criticism, if it's well thought out, it will just be dismissed as anti-Semitism, although there is no attacks intended by it. And obviously our discussion tonight is obviously not intended as a personal or ethnic attack. It's intended as an analysis of the world we see around us. He says, a major theme of this volume, found especially in chapters 6 and 7, is that intellectual defences of Judaism and of Jewish theories of anti-Semitism have throughout its history played a critical role in maintaining Judaism as a group evolutionary strategy. And this is what we were referring to earlier about the fact that when they come out with saying that the Gentiles are very, very anti-Semitic, that causes the other Jews to associate with them. One of the ways that they do that is through their history, and their history is full of all these terrible things happening to them. They never concentrate on the good things in their history. They always concentrate on the bad things and all these marches that they've had and all these pogroms that went on, and they will always portray themselves as being entirely innocent, and all these terrible things happen to them. And if Jews today don't want these terrible things to happen, then they have to identify with Jews as a group, and they have to do whatever they can to spot any anti-Semitism, just the smallest criticism, because that could then enlarge itself into a pogrom, basically. And their history plays into this. And that's the theories of anti-Semitism throughout history, which has played such a critical role in maintaining them. And he says here the intellectual defences of Judaism. And I guess that he's talking about the religious aspects of it there. I mean, they do like to hide the less savoury aspects of the Talmud and promote the more positive aspects of it, such as that they're trying to repair the world, tikkun olam, and if you save one life, you've saved the whole of humanity, and similar things goes on with the Quran. But then if you dare to bring out the more negative aspects of the Talmud, say some of the ways that it talks about Jesus and Mary, or some of the ways that it talks about how to deceive the Gentiles, then that will automatically get classed as anti-Semitism, and they'll try to silence it. I don't know if you want to comment on any of that, Horace.
Yeah, it really... this makes me think of... I always wonder... Like, let's take now. I mean, Jews in America are certainly Jewish billionaires, Jewish politicians, lawyers, and in several other very important fields, you know, Jews are, although maybe not wholly dominant, but like have power way beyond their numbers would suggest. And the collective effect, obviously, is just the rapid and tragic decline of white America. You know, similar things will happen in other countries, or are happening in other countries. Seems particularly rapid and horrible in America. And it makes me wonder, what is the long-term plan? Is there a long-term plan there? I mean, is it to try and rule over this rapidly expanding but like darkening population, who can be controlled and exploited? But surely there's going to be major problems that the state can't address. I mean, you know, there's this big aim driven by a mixture of Jews and Gentiles, people like Matthew Iglesias and Glenn Beck, who used to be thought of as a right-wing figure, to reach this 1 billion person population America. A billion people in America. Obviously, that's almost entirely going to come from Africa and Asia and Latin America. What do Jews really, but you know, the Jews who are driving that, do they really believe that that's going to be good for them? I don't have the answer to this, but it just makes me think, is the idea to just get ever more anti-white and ever more in control and ever more restrictive in what people can say until there's some sort of total Jewish dictatorship, but which at the same time denies that it is Jewish? I mean, you know, again, I don't know if there's any way to answer that right now, or, you know, or if there is a plan, that's the thing. But that's what I think of when when we talk about long-term, I don't know, when we talk about the effect of Jewish activism or where it's leading. It's just kind of a mystery to me. I mean, in my imagination, it's not good for them ultimately. It's good for them perhaps for another, you know, few decades or something. But if you've got ever increasing numbers of Muslims in America, you are going to have, I assume, some people would deny this. Some people say even Muslims will just be, sort of assimilated into global homo. I doubt that. I really, really doubt that. You know, you're going to have a large part of the population, maybe hundreds of millions of people who do not want to support Israel and who are aware that Jews are in charge and don't like it. Surely that, you know, it's the same thing. Like I've said to this Jewish friend that I mentioned that, you know, I can tell you, and I can list them now, like 20 Jewish organizations just in Britain working to get immigrants, mostly Muslims, into Britain and to get them British citizenship and to root them and empower them and give them their own schools and so on. I've made videos about this where I lay out the names of the organizations, the people involved, the people driving it. As to why, I struggle. I mean, and it confused my friend. They're like, well, why though? Why on earth would that would destroy us? And I'm like, well, yeah, I don't have the answer to that. But presumably, the idea, and I project this idea onto our rule, you know, rulers of our ethnicity as well, is the idea is to live in some kind of ultra protected elite status, like where they've got armored cars and, you know, an armored convoy wherever they go, and the rest of the country, you know, just there'll be certain areas like, I don't know, you know, certain gated communities, and the rest of the country will be more or less violent chaos. I mean, not totally. People will still try to live, you know, in some sort of peace of some kind, but it will just be, you know, wanton criminality and just no love and no peace anywhere. And I mean, that's all that I can envision. If that's not the plan, what on earth is? I have no idea.
Well, there's a few things in that that I think that come to mind. If we look in the past, we see that there's been cycles. Jews have come to a certain amount of power. There's been conflict over resources, and there's been a revolt against that power, and Jews have been ejected from a country, and their group evolutionary strategy has been based around them living in other countries, basically, ever since the Romans destroyed the temple and expelled them from Judea, they've lived as a tight ethnic group within other ethnic groups. So their group evolutionary strategy the whole time has been about them living among these other groups. Maybe they've only just arrived in that country because they've just been expelled from another one, so they have to work their way up. It doesn't actually compensate for when they get to the level of power that they possibly have today and the level of influence that they possibly have today. It's probably greater than they've ever had before. So the group evolutionary strategy doesn't really understand that. It hasn't got to grips with that yet. And if we look back at what happened when they had total control in the USSR, it was majority Jewish, majority Jewish run, the communists were, particularly in the beginning, and they ended up running it into the ground. It just seems that as if they have a natural instinctive way of doing things that it requires them to be in a different position in society rather than being at the top. That they form a force of chaos, if you will, and we form a force of order, and we struggle against that chaos, and all the while the chaos doesn't have that much power. It's a good thing, and it encourages us to bring more order into the world. But when that chaos gets too much power, then it can end up destroying things for them as well. Maybe that's a few things that we can think about in that.
So, I mean, obviously you would agree that you know, that it's significant that Israel obviously exists as of 1948, and as of, I think, the 1980s or 70s, it has nuclear weapons as well, right? So that should make a massive difference to the whole situation, you know, this ongoing sort of conflict and an interplay between Jews and Europeans. Are you saying sort of like, I mean, I assume you would agree that that's significant. Are you saying that they're probably in a, you know, just only in the early stages of adapting to that fact? They're adapting. So, because I mean, even in a world with Israel, you know, being able to really defend itself against almost any country or any situation with nukes, I mean, albeit a terrible cost, I assume, if a nuclear war happens. But, I mean, I can see why it would still be desirable to control, if possible, other powerful nations, you know, to make them friendly to Israel. And obviously that is happening, I think, now more than ever before. You know, American, you know, Zionism appears to totally control America. Apparently renegade types like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or whoever, you know, these potential threats, they seem to be assimilated within a few months of entering the Congress. which took me by surprise. They seemed so pugnacious beforehand.
I think Israel is a new factor to it. Basically, them having their own homeland somewhere that hasn't really been, they didn't have anything like that before. So obviously the societies that they are in, they work within those societies to advance their own interests, but also to advance the interests of their own country that they have now. And really, I was referring to the position that they have in the Western societies today, which I would say over the last century, they've risen up to a position that is higher than they have ever had before. Before the French Revolution, they were kept separate and they didn't have the same rights as everybody else. But over the last 200 years, that they've managed to raise themselves up into more power than they've ever had before, I would suggest. And adding their own homeland to it now, their own country as well, that does add another factor in there. But I don't think the group evolutionary strategy has learned to compensate for them having all that power yet, because what they did in the USSR, I mean, it destroyed the place. Really. And as you point out, the more Muslims there are, the more of a threat it's going to be to them. So it's almost too dangerous for them to have so much influence. It's that it's dangerous to themselves as well, not just to the people that they are in competition with.
Yeah, I think that's a very, very important thing. Yeah, I guess the answer to the sort of conundrum that I raised was that It's always a mistake to think of Jews as a monolith. I mean, there is perhaps a sort of monolithic leadership to it. Perhaps, you know, that, you know, sort of the, what is often called Zionism, or Zionists, I guess, or something like that. But Obviously, yeah, Jews are diverse, and I guess it's, I mean, it's certainly at times I forget that, and they don't, you know, there's no one controlling hand over all of them. So, yeah, we're talking, I mean, obviously the same applies to us a great deal more, but yeah, there's forces, I mean, probably the most intelligent Jews are probably alarmed at what some of the more wild and radical ones are doing, because it gives, I don't know, because it gives Jews a bad name, or because it upsets the situation in, you know, it makes things unpredictable. So, I mean, but at the same time, I think it's significant that we don't see a great deal of, I think we see less struggle among, you know, between different Jewish forces against each other than we do amongst Europeans. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, they will always work together. I mean, I think what we're possibly bringing in now is the philosophical side to it, and we can add Dr. E. Michael Jones' theory about when they rejected Christ and he was the Logos personified, they were rejecting order, and they then became the forces of chaos. So whether they're on the right or whether they're on the left, they seem to have this instinctual drive towards chaos. So when they do end up having lots of power, you get lots of chaos, which is a threat to them as much as it is to us. But as I say, that's more of a philosophical side. Getting back to what Kevin MacDonald says here, he says parts of the book read as a sort of extended discourse on the role of Jewish self-interest. And obviously what he's talking about there is policies that benefit Jews at the expense of the host society. And this ties in with another point he makes, which is the Jewish deception of the host society. So we have this pretense that the policies that they're talking about are to benefit everyone, such as multiculturalism, the separation of church and state, free trade, legalization of pornography, same-sex marriage. I mean, all of these things will be sold to the Gentile society as if they're very, very good things. They're good for everyone. But in actual fact, they're not good for us. They attack the heart of our society, which is the family and our ethnic homogeneity. And all the while we are being weakened, they're being strengthened by this. So because with more diversity, the less it is that they stand out. The weaker our families are, the stronger their families are. They encourage as much breeding as possible, particularly amongst the ultra-Orthodox, and a lot of their families ban television. They won't have their children watching the television because they know how degenerate it is. That's for the Gentile society. So there's this deception there, and it's the deception is that we think that these things are good things and that they're for everyone. And what we miss out is the effect that they have on advancing Jewish interests rather than our own interests.
It definitely is deception as well, because nobody can seriously believe that diversifying white countries has done anything good for white people whatsoever. So when I see a white person saying it, I think that person is deluded. Whereas when I see, say, Sadiq Khan saying it, I think, well, that makes sense, you know. And it's the same with Jews. I mean, Sadiq Khan obviously is Muslim, but like I just see blatant malevolence in that man's in the things he says and the way he conducts himself. Like, he knows damn well that when he says diversity is our strength, he means us non-Brits, right? And I mean, that idea, I think it's in, is it in Separation, is it, I think it's maybe in Cultural Critique, but Kevin MacDonald quotes, I think, the first known use of the sense of the term diversity is our strength. And it is by a Jew. It was a Jew who first said it. I can't remember. It's not one that I've heard of in any other context. And it first started being used by politicians, as far as I can tell, by Bill Clinton. And the person who wrote the speech in which he first said it was also Jewish. It's a Jewish claim that diversity is our strength. But when they say our, they mean their, you know, like, it's diversity is the strength of those who are against white people. and they know that. They do know that. This is what I mean about the deception, self-deception thing. I think it's a very, very important thing to discuss, but it's really hard to know, how much of it is deception, how much of it is self-deception. I err towards, you know, it's mostly deception, and the self-deception aspect of it is is an inconvenience. But you can't ignore either. Those two things go together. You have to sort of say them as one phrase, because it's one thing that just, you know, by an accident of language has to be described as two. But it is one process. It's one way or another, you need the goyim to think this. So you deceive them, and if necessary, yourself. That's the way I understand that.
And of course, with their influence on the newspapers and the media, that's the way that they're able to do this. They will manufacture public opinion rather than report on public opinion. And we can particularly see the way that the reporting is done on nationalist groups, because obviously if it's ethno-nationalism, then that excludes the Jews from that group. So they will report on that in a negative way. But whenever they're talking about Jews, it will always be reported in a positive way. So you see this deception there as well. And the next bit that I've taken from the contents from Separation and Its Discontents is actually about self-deception. It says Jewish self-deception in the areas of Jewish historiography. And this is in the way that they tell their own histories, where they talk about how they're a poor, oppressed minority that have been victimized for no reason, and that anti-Semitism is a pathology rather than a logical and at times justified response to identify what's going on and try to draw attention to it. But it's also moved on from that now. It's not just the history that they tell themselves, which portrays them as completely blameless and never having done anything wrong in the whole of history. But now, because they have such a level of influence on our media, they're involved in the history that's taught to us. Whenever you see a program on the television that's talking about Christian history, it would be a Jew that's presenting it. And the history that is being taught to us is a Jewish version of history. And this is, I think, why we get this idea that's being taught that we had black people here all throughout our history, which is encouraged by companies like Netflix and the BBC, which will insert diversity into these historical programs where there never was any before. And it's all these companies that have a large portion of Jews that are within them, and they all come out with all these reasons for it. Well, we have to have representation of the people that are here today. It's a very good thing. We want these people to feel at home here in our country. And this is the way that it we put across, that it's a wonderful thing that somebody famous from our past is being played by a black actor. So we now have this deception that's going on within our history, whereas before it just went on in Jewish history, and it was just about how they were entirely blameless. Now we have this other deception within our own history, which particularly at Radio Albion, we try to point this out, and obviously all nationalists do, but particularly these historical programs that we see that get a lot of viewers, and they'll have a black woman playing a famous wife of a king, or they'll have famous gods of our past that will be played by black people. I mean, this is a new thing that's happened just in the last 20 years, really, that it's gone this far. And of course, we also actually have the Holocaust itself, which is told entirely from the Jews. We don't actually get to hear what the Gentiles that were, like, particularly the Germans that were National Socialists, we don't really get to hear what they have to say about it. And they've even gone so far as to make it illegal in some countries to investigate it and come out with any counter narrative to the ones that the alleged Jewish eyewitnesses came out with. So that there's a lot of deception that's going on in the areas of history, in Jewish historiography, and it's progressed into our history now. Do you want to comment on that, Horace?
Okay, yeah, I mean, like, if it was only the case that Jews were telling each other a false version of history, or a convenient, or a sort of a religious sort of version of history, like, you know, sort of, you know, a version of history constructed without any real attention to the truth, but it's to serve a particular purpose. If it was just among them, I would probably look down on it, but I wouldn't try and interfere. But the rewriting of our history, I find profoundly, not only objectionable, but threatening. I see behind that a genocidal intent, and that really does make me, livid when I see, because some people, they'll see this thing. There's a channel called History Debunked, and this guy is a little bit sort of complacent in my eyes. He'll review, he'll talk about a lot of the same things we do, but he'll chuckle at it as if it's all daft. So, you know, for example, like this he started talking about the adverts that are being, you know, black and, you know, just usually black man, white woman. And he's also touched on, yeah, his historical series. And he knows it's ridiculous, but he'll treat it as something daft that's basically going to blow over. Whereas I see it as something that has to be fought and turned, you know, undone. Because I would say to people, make no mistake, the idea is to make children and then whole generations and then their children and so on and then everyone believe that in reality Queen Elizabeth or whoever was black. Or, and, you know, Anne Boleyn or whatever. The idea is to replace history with fiction, and to make the fiction seem real and to denounce history as white history or white supremacist history. So in, I can see in 20 years, it will be common for people to insist that Anne Boleyn really was black or Richard the Lionheart or anyone, you know, they'll probably shift it to people who we admire. They'll say they were black. Which is something that various black supremacists, including black supremacists who consider themselves the real Jews, which is interesting. Like if people have seen that Louis Theroux episode from the late 90s, that's one example. That's something they do. They go back and they just say all the best people like Beethoven and whatever, he was black. The scummy ones, you know, the ones who did bad things, you know, it's more debatable, you know. But they'll say Henry VIII, yeah, it's not clear, you know, because they're not clear whether they like him. But that really infuriates me. But the Holocaust, I would say, I mean, it's so important. In you know, it's been such a determining thing since it was said to have happened. And I believe that really, more than anything else, has forced upon us what you could, you know, what Atzmon would call Jerusalemite thinking, which is, you know, you're not. You people, you're not allowed to be philosophical about this. Your thing of loving knowledge or, you know, exploring things and curiosity and trying to figure things out for yourself, that all of that just converges on a railway back to Auschwitz. You know, these are all just branch lines back to Auschwitz. So I'm sorry, you have to go our way, right? We have a commandment that is, we've written history, you obey it, you repeat it, you teach it to your children, and that's that. It's a commandment. And, I think Stryker Mike, you know, Mike Enoch, yeah, Eric, yeah. Stryker, I think they focus on it. And people really sort of, some people mock them for being so focused on the Jewish question. And I think those people are wrong. I think the Jewish question is very important. And the Holocaust really is like the plug in the bath. It's the linchpin of our current oppression. So people are absolutely right to focus on it. And those guys actually do it very intelligently as well, which, you know, is to their credit, because a lot of people, as with September 11th and things like that, get distracted by things that matter less. So Stryker Mike, you know, they really go to the heart of it. And I think they're doing great work.
Oh, it's quite central to the reason why things are the way that they are today. But just to go back to what you were saying about the inserting of diversity in our history, you have to look at that as again, the play of order against chaos and darkness against light. And what that does is it forces us as nationalists to learn about our history and understand it and speak about it and speak about it to the next generation to ensure that they understand their history. A lot of nationalists really don't know much about history. And the more that we see these TV companies putting black people into our history, the more likely it is that people are going to actually look at that real history and understand it and know more about it. So, you know, it's going to have an unintended effect. They think what it's going to cause is us to just believe it and think that they've always been here. But I tend to think, well, no, I think what it's going to cause is for people to actually take a renewed interest in history and understand where we come from and understand more about our identity and understand our role as custodians of the past. It's up to us to pass on a truthful understanding of history to the next generation. And that's going to encourage that. That's something that we try to do here a lot of Radio Albion is look at our past, particularly the British past, and have a look at the primary source documents and see how it relates to today. A lot of the stuff that was going on 2,000 years ago when we were having interactions with Rome bears a lot of, well, an uncanny similarity to our interactions today with the European Union. And it's only because our history has been attacked in that way that we've really felt inspired to go and look at what really went on. So, that, you know, whatever negative things are done against us, there are always positive things that we can do back. The other side of self-deception here, Jewish self-deception, is in personal identity, where they will claim that they come from the Israelites, and they'll claim this heritage that goes back to the Bible, which is of great benefit to them, especially among Zionist Christians and evangelical Christians. Whereas in actual fact, you can just tell from their DNA tests without even looking at their history that they are of mixed ethnicity. You've got Turkic, Khazars, Arabians, Sepharvaim, Canaanite, Edomians, and Europeans. And yet they claim to be these chosen people. And at the same time, they'll claim to be just as European as any other European, especially if they're going to talk about terrible things whites have done. They will pretend to be white and say, my fellow whites. But then, of course, when they're talking about being victims, then they will be the poor, oppressed Jews that understand what it's like to be oppressed. So we have a lot of deception that's going on there in their personal identity. Do you want to comment on any of that, Horace?
Well, it's the thing of putting ethnic interest above truth, which is somewhat alien to us. I mean, there are white people who do that, but I think it's not the norm. Whereas among Jews, it does seem to be the norm. It's like, well, the truth comes second. I mean, it's not that it's of no value to them. You know, there are brilliant Jewish philosophers, scientists, and so on. Like, you know, truth, obviously, objectivity matters to them a great deal. But yeah, as a collective, as part of the group strategy, truth is definitely secondary. I would just underline what you said about, you know, about the importance of rediscovering our history, partly in reaction. I think it's something we should do anyway, but partly in reaction to these lies that are being told about our people now and in the past. I mean, that's something for which you and Dennis, you know, doing this deserve great credit, and Carolyn Yeager and the Institute for Historical Review and all the other, and it takes a degree of bravery, all the other revisionists. And I would just repeat that dictum that all history is revisionist history. So there's nothing dirty about revisionism. There's nothing, like sort of peripheral about that. That is what history is. Revisionism is one and the same thing. So I just want to give big credit to you and Dennis for doing that, you know, and thanks for having me on to be part of it, you know.
Well, it's great to have you on, and I'm sure listeners appreciate it just as much as I do. There are as many different views of history as there are witnesses. This is the thing. They'll try and say, oh, there's just one view of the Holocaust, this happened, and that's it. But, you know, there are always different witnesses to different events, and they're all going to have a different way of explaining it. And rather than looking at history through Jewish eyes, I'd like to go back to the primary source documents that were written by British people. You know, that's one of the ones that really fascinates me, is looking back at the Brute, the English Chronicle, and the way that they saw things. And you can really get a feel that they really valued chivalry and honour and morals, incredibly moral people. And it's the same when you go back and look at the books that were written by the people that were involved in slavery in the south of America. And we're told that there were these horrible people that beat and mistreat these slaves. But if you actually read books that are written by them, again, they're incredibly moral, upright Christian people that are incredibly merciful, that valued these really important traits. They valued altruism. They valued generosity. If you were a wealthy man, you were expected to be generous and to help the poor. And a lot of the people that we've looked at to do with the British Empire in the Greatest Britain series, again, they have really helped out the poor. Anybody that had wealth in our past was expected to look after the poor. You contrast that to the people that have wealth today, people like George Soros that are trying to dissolve the nations and destroy what we've built and destroy civilization. It's the complete opposite. But we're coming up to the end of the episode here, Horace. Have you got any final thoughts, anything else that you'd like to say at the end here before we finish? Any new content?
I think that was good. If we could reduce the whole conversation to one sentence, it's George Soros is not chivalric. But yeah, no, thanks for having me on again. Yeah, I really enjoy it and find this really valuable. So yeah, thanks, Finn.
Well, it's great to have you here, and I'm hoping you will come back next week to do part three. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more Truthful Out Radio for you, and of course we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.